So hello. So I changed my title. I replaced the word secular by quasi-linear because I understood that secular is a bit of a loaded word, which means different things for different people. So this is work done in collaboration, work done mostly by Jean-Baptiste Fouvry, who's now just got a position in Paris, and in collaboration with James Binney, Pierre-Henri Chavany, Simon Prunet, and John McGorion. And a fair fraction of it is actually inspired by a lot of the work that Martin Weinberg has been doing on this topic over the last 20 years. So since I never know whether I reached the end of my talk, I give you the bring-home message or the upshot. So the qualitative upshot is that quasi-linear theory rocks. So I'm going to try and convince you that this is the case. But and the other message was mostly to myself. I should never have skipped the chapter on kinetic theory in Binet and Tremaine when I was reading it, because to me kinetic theory sounded a bit boring because I wasn't particularly interested in velocities. I wanted to do dynamics, but actually this was a misunderstanding on my part. Anyway, so quasi-linear theory is trying to understand. To introduce some level of nonlinearity in the way you describe the self-gravitating system. And I will show you that it corresponds to the stellar version of the dissipation fluctuation theorem, which allows you to describe how the orbital structure of a galaxy is going to diffuse away from its mean field lock trajectory. So as you all know, the galaxy formation process really sets up galaxies into a very unlikely state of quasi-circular orbits. And they will take any opportunity they have to rearrange themselves into something else, as long as there is some source of fluctuation within the system, whether it being internal or external. And as a physicist, you can decide what you define to be the system and what's internal and what's external. And I will show you that by playing this game, you can write different equations which allow you to describe the system from a different angle. And so the method I'm going to describe is very classic in physics. It's time decoupling. I'm going to assume that something's varying slowly compared to something else. And in order to account for self-gravity, I will use the so-called matrix method, which was developed by Karl Nice in the 70s to take into account the fact that gravity is long range, which emphasized the importance of resonances in self-gravitating systems. So why do we want to do this? Because it allows us to say something about what the system is doing involving nonlinearities within the system. And that's interesting because once you describe nonlinearities, rather just a linear response of system, you can quantify not only the state of equilibrium that you're considering, but you get also a handle on what is perturbing the system. So what is the power spectrum of perturbations, for instance, which is something that sometimes we want to quantify. We could use Gaia, for instance, to try and say something about the fluctuation in the dark halo and such. So it's interesting to be able to write down the nonlinear theory. Another advantage of using quasi-linear theory is it allows us to break the problem by scale. We can focus, say, on the galactic center and consider the galaxy itself as a source of perturbation. We can consider the galaxy as the object and consider the cosmic environment as a perturbation, etc. It also allows us to break the system by component. And by this, I mean, as I just said, you can consider the system to be made of, say, the stars in the disk and the giant molecular clouds as being a source of internal fluctuation of the potential. Or you can consider the perturbation to be the bar. So you would say the bar is an external perturbation to the Milky Way. And when doing so, you will not write exactly the same diffusion equation. A property of doing quasi-linear theory is you... The problem of doing quasi-linear theory is you need to phase average your equations, which means that you're not describing an object by itself, you're describing an ensemble average of objects, which I think is interesting because climate is more interesting than weather, and also because external galaxies give us access to many realizations of different galaxies. So we can see things which are of more generality if we ensemble average results rather than look at the peculiarities of a given object. But that's also a consequence of trying to solve equations non-linearly and say something about the average behavior, because you need to average over the initial conditions in some sense. Quasi-linear theory is a theory, so it can be parameterized, so we can look at and it can be simplified in the sense that, for instance, as I will show you, we can take WKB limit on the effect of spirals, we can switch off gravity, etc. We can look at So this is to be contrasted with simulations, which are just one realization of a given set of parameters. And if I have time, I'll explain why one of these two equations provides a correct description of the Chandrasekhar friction. And as quoting James in a recent lecture he gave in Oxford, Chandrasekhar wrongly assumed that Keplerian deflection was the source of fluctuation in self-gravitating system, whereas if you solve the diffusion equation that is provided by quasi-linear theory, you convince yourself that it's actually the long-range interactions which are happening through resonances, which is actually the main source of fluctuation in a self-gravitating system. So the cons are that you need to make this time decoupling assumption that I've mentioned, so it doesn't capture the specificities of today's weather. It assumes integrability, but I will argue that this is not a very strong shortcoming, and it's not completely trivial to implement in its full glory if you want to do it semi-analytically, but there are shortcuts if you want to use your favorite n-body solvers. And it's very relevant, and I guess this is the topic of this conference, in order to understand a lot of the features which have already been discussed this morning in Gaia, to account for the nonlinearities, the importance of resonances, streams in the dark halo, the thick disk, radial and churning and blurring bars, and the transformations of cusps into cores. So it's a long bring-home message, but in some sense my talk's finished. If it was so for me, it's good. Okay, so let's step back and try to be a bit more pedagogical and present to you the equations and the results. So we want to use secular dynamics to describe what's happening to a stable self-gravitating system over a Hubble time. So we know that galaxies will respond to external perturbations, and it will impact the way it evolves over a long time scale, so how it walks along the Hubble fork, for instance. And it also reacts to internal perturbation. So the first is, you can think of it as nurture, and the second as nature, and the first equation which describes the first process is described by the so-called Dressel-Fokker-Planck diffusion equation, and the second equation is described by something which has been imported from plasma physics in some sense, and improved recently, which is called the Balasko-Linear diffusion equation. So this is of interest for Gaia, obviously, because we want to understand what is the origin of this ridge that we saw earlier. Can we quantitatively predict their shapes, and can we use their properties, the properties of these ridges, to say something about what is causing the diffusion process in action space? And it's the point of doing this secular dynamics is to understand what's happening to the system on timescales which are long compared to dynamical timescale. And as I will show you, in such a framework, what's important is resonant effect. And this is what's driving the secular evolution. So we want to understand what happened to the orbital structure on cosmic age. Okay, so I mentioned already the dissipation fluctuation theorem. Everybody knows that ink diffuses in water. So the question is, does something similar happen to galaxy? And the answer is yes. So the diffusion dissipation theorem relates the diffusion rate of ink in water to the power spectrum of the fluctuating force induced by the molecules in the water, right? So in stars, we have the same process, but what's diffusing is not the position of the ink molecule, it's the shape of the orbits. So it's the actions which are diffusing in action space. And one specificity of a self-gravitating system is that self-gravity is long-range. So in order to diffuse, the stars needs to resonate, otherwise they will follow the mean field, as I mentioned earlier. They're locked in this boring, doing their epicycle kind of thing. And an important other aspect is because of self-gravity, the impact of this diffusion is actually typically 10,000 times stronger than you would naively think, because any perturbation within the disk is going to be amplified by the fact that other stars polarize around it. And because in the diffusion process, we will see that this polarization factor is squared, the effect on diffusion is going to be much larger. So again, the purpose of this talk is to understand how stars' orbits distort in the cosmic framework. Okay, so let me draw you a cartoon here. We're going to look at what a star feels while it's describing its orbit, and taking into account that there are some external or internal source of fluctuations which makes its potential fluctuate as it moves along the orbit. So this is when actions come handy, but you don't have to use actions. I know there's a bit of an anti-action spirit these days. Anyway, you have to represent the unperturbed trajectory is good, and actions have the property of doing this nicely for you if the system is integrable, but it doesn't have to be actions. Anyway, the potential as you follow the orbit can be transposed, can be expanded into harmonics by using the angle action coordinates and doing representation, doing also a transformation with respect to time, a Laplace transform with respect to time. And so from the measure of this fluctuation, I can measure the power spectrum in the harmonics with respect to the angles, right? I just need to take this quantity, take its modulus, square it, and take the ensemble average. So this is the quantity which is going to be sourcing the diffusion in this process. The only specificity of having a self-gravitating system is going to be that it's not actually the perturbation in the potential which matters, it's the perturbation of the total potential, which is the potential which is external, plus the fraction which has been amplified by the self-response of the system. So the fact that it's gravity induces that this is not the same as this, because this potential needs to be dressed. And on top of that, because it's the resonance which matter, the only frequencies which are of relevance in how the star is being perturbed is those which match the frequency of the underlying system. And this is very, very important, and it explains why we see these ridges in Gaia. Because the idea is the following. If you hit the star as it moves along its orbit at frequencies which don't match its internal frequency, it will basically not respond. Conversely, if your modulation of perturbation happens to be low frequency, then it will only resonate with the low frequency harmonic, and so you will see only that directions of diffusion corresponding to the low value of this M number here, right? So it's really a consequence of the fact that the galaxy is being hit by something like Sagittarius, and Sagittarius is not high, it's not hitting the galactic disk at high frequency, it's hitting it at low frequency, which will induce diffusion in preferred direction, because only the low M's will matter. Okay, so I stole this slide from James, so I'll give you a sort of quick qualitative derivation of where it comes from, because I want to convince you that there's nothing exotic or special about what we're doing. It's actually quite easy to derive, at least initially. So what you do is you start by your Boltzmann's equation, and you're going to write your distribution function as a low-varying component corresponding to the secular underlying equilibrium, plus some fluctuating component, and you're just going to assume that this is varying much more rapidly than that. You plug this into this equation, and then you phase average it, and so you're going to get an equation for the slowly varying component and an equation for the rapidly varying component. The equation for the rapidly varying component, because you've linearized the equation, you know how to solve, and it's been done by Kahnleis in the 70s. So you plug one into the other, and this is the equation for the slow varying component. So it's basically saying that the rate of change of the slow varying distribution function is the Poisson bracket at phased average of the fluctuation. So if the fluctuation in potential is correlated with the fluctuation in the distribution function, which typically will be if your system is partially self-gravitating, then this Poisson bracket will not be zero, and it will be sourcing the rate of change of the unperturbed equilibrium. And so if you actually do this and do a bit more maths, you find that the equation takes the shape of a conservation equation, and also it takes the shape of a diffusion equation. So it has to be the divergence of some flux, because stars are conserved, so no stars are being lost in this problem. So it has this shape, and then the flux vector is actually a classical heat-like diffusion equation, except the diffusion is not a scalar, it's a tensor, right? It's a diffusion tensor, and it has these harmonic numbers corresponding to the angle harmonic decomposition we done earlier. And because it has this harmonic number, if this sum is truncated, the diffusion will be very anisotropic. It will happen along preferred directions, right? Given by, say, 2 minus 1 if it's inner Lindblad, 2, 0 if it's co-rotation, 2 plus 1, etc. And then it has this weight, which is the diffusion coefficient, which depends on the corresponding harmonic. And as I've already hinted, the diffusion coefficient is actually exactly, and this is not a qualitative hand-waving argument, it's the result of doing the math, so to speak. It's actually exactly the total potential harmonic at the resonant frequency of the system. And as I've already mentioned, you can think of this as the external power spectrum in harmonic space divided by the gravitational susceptibility of your system, which is going to be amplifying the response because all the other stars are responding to given fluctuations by changing their trajectories through the resonances. And so you can think of this as what it is you measure when you're matching those diffusion ridges that are seen in action space. You're measuring something which captures the external source of perturbation, if you describe the system as being externally driven, and something which characterizes the underlying equilibrium, and I'll come back to exactly what this expression is. I want to emphasize once again this point about anisotropy. If I consider my diffusion equation with my diffusion tensor here, plotted on top of one of Sellwood's diffusion in action space, here I'm considering angular momentum versus radial action. If I let a system evolve long enough, it will develop these ridges in action space. And these ridges are along lines of constant fast action for each harmonic. So in principle, you've got lines in all possible directions, right? But they are always discrete for the low ends, and then there are more and more of them. But if the diffusion coefficient, so this is the most important part of my talk. I need to make this right. So what we have here is we have a diffusion equation. So what matters is the gradient of the distribution function in that space. So where is the gradient steepest? Well, you can see that the gradient is steeper, say, in this direction than in that direction. But because of these harmonic numbers, this direction is actually a high M. So if the perturbation is slowly varying, it won't be preferred. So it prefers the low M, so it prefers this direction. And the diffusion direction have to be along lines of constant J, constant fast action. And because you can rewrite this term as a derivative of respect to angular momentum at fast action. And I remind you that the diffusion coefficient is to be taken at the temporal frequency associated with the underlying frequency of the system for this harmonic. So if the perturbation is low frequency, then it means that the dms are going to be decreasing rapidly as a function of m. And so it's only this preferred direction given by the lower order resonance which will drive the diffusion. So anything, as I've already mentioned, that makes the potential fluctuate at low frequency will create ridges in phase space as found by Gaia. So the point I'm trying to make here is that some of what Wilmer's ridges are likely to, you can ask yourself whether it's the bar or the spiral or this or that, but from the point of view of this theory, which is, I believe, the quantitative theory to understand to make predictions about the shape of the diffusion, etc., what matters is that it makes the potential fluctuate. You don't need to decide whether it's the bar or the this or the that. What the data tells you is you have a measure of the diffusion coefficient along these ridges. And as long as the process is making the potential fluctuate from the point of view of the unperturbed system, then it's captured. Okay, so now I am going to give you how to apply this to various scales. So I guess here I'm going to focus mostly on the galactic disk and on radial migration and blurring and churning and disk thickening. And I want to say it can be applied also to the galactic center to understand the last parsec problem and how to spin up black holes and how to put constraints on the dark cluster in the vicinity of the galactic center. Can be applied to galactic halos, but I won't have much time to talk about this, and to streams as well. So this is the archetype of the so-called radial migration problem. We measure here Anil Ali measures here the change in the guiding radius as a function of guiding radius within a simulation. Can the ridge in action space explain this process? And can it explain also simultaneously the disk thickening that is also observed? So I said I mentioned the galactic center and streams. Maybe I should say something about streams because some people here are interested in streams. If you write the Langevin-Itô, which is the stochastic counterpart of this diffusion equation, you will find that the rate of change of the actions is given by essentially the square root of the diffusion tensor times some stochastic variables. And so if you measure the change of the broadening of streams as a function of angle along the stream, you have an estimate of the diffusion tensor, which gives you an estimate of the power spectrum of fluctuations. And so one specificity about streams is that you need to do it at fixed orbital parameters, because you only have one action and two sets of angle which define where the stream is. So what is its apogalacticon and what's its plane of orbit. Okay, so galaxies are perturbed if we know that we live in a live cosmic environment. So external perturbation, you need to use the Fokker-Planck equation, and internal perturbation, I will present to you the Balaise-Coulenard equation. And so taking into account both sources of fluctuation should allow us eventually to make the distinction between external versus self-induced perturbation. This is the synopsis of what's happening to a galaxy. You have your galaxy and its stars are rotating. There are other populations, possibly of more massive objects. There are external perturbation. Each star polarizes a given wake. And so what happens to the galaxy on long time scale after its phase of violent relaxation depends on the relative strength of external versus internal perturbations. And on secular time scale, the system will drift its orbital structure to a new equilibrium. And this new equilibrium might be unstable, so it might lead to linear instability. And the important point is that resonant effect drives this secular evolution. So galaxies are self-gravitating, and this is I want to emphasize this a little bit because this is one of the novelty of the more recent work on this topic. We all know since Carl Nice's work that when you imply some external perturbation to the distribution to the equilibrium, it induces a new distribution function which corresponds to a new density, which itself will adapt itself to the external perturbation. So in order to take into account this positive loop of retroaction, you need to use potential density basis a la Carl Nice. The effect of this is that since TUMRE 81, we know that even in a stable disk, a leading spiral will unwind into a trailing one and will be strongly boosted by the self-gravity of the system. So the apparatus I've just mentioned wants to represent this strong amplification. So the way you do it is you expand the perturbation and the self-response onto basis function, and you get this amplification mechanism, which tells you that the amplification of the potential is sourced by itself with an amplification factor, which is matrix-like because of the fact that gravity is long distance, and which involves the gradient of the distribution function divided by some resonant denominator. So it's telling you that resonance are important. And it tells you that the gradient of the distribution is important in specifying what this response matrix is. So this is classics. And now we want to bring this to the nonlinear regime. So there's some literature on this system, on this problem, sorry. And I'm first going to present to you the case when the source of perturbation is external. So when the source of perturbation is external, you get this diffusion equation. So it has exactly the shape that I mentioned earlier. But the exact expression, and now I can be less vague about what the susceptibility is, the diffusion coefficient is going to be the autocorrelation of the external perturbation that I mentioned earlier, evaluated at the frequency, as I mentioned earlier. And this is the factor of amplification, where I've given you the expression for M. So it's a matrix-like amplification factor. And as you see, the resonance is, as I mentioned earlier, anisotropic, and it's boosted by this thing, which can be quite large. So I remind you for the expression of what the matrix response is. So the way you deal with having to do to compute this matrix response is you discretize phase space, and you make an analytic approximation for the numerator, and you integrate analytically through the resonance, and then you validate that you've computed correctly your matrix by looking at unstable modes for different sets of parameters for the distribution function. The second equation is the inhomogeneous Balaise-Coulenard equation, which describes the secular evolution of system made of a finite number of particles. And it can be multi-species, so you can think of stars plus molecular clouds, or massive stars plus light stars, say in the galactic center, etc. And it actually corresponds to the transposition of something which was known in plasma physics, known as the Ballesculenar equation. And the Ballesculenar equation is what captures the Debye sphere, if some of you have some background in plasma physics. And so the idea is the following. If I consider why can a system which is not being externally perturbed spontaneously drive itself into a new state? The stars within the system needs to resonate. So I don't know whether this is completely obvious for this audience or not, but let me just give you a reminder. So we're going to consider a red and a blue star which are rotating, but which happen to be co-rotating, resonating in some co-rotating frame. So I don't know if you saw this, but if I move to a rotating frame by rotating the frame at the top, there's a frame in which these two orbits are resonating. So this is the frame in which they resonate. So the blue one is captured in a sort of inner Lindblad resonance, and the second one in co-rotation, as has been nicely explained by Wilner earlier. And there is a frame in which there is this coincidence between the frequencies of these two orbits. So the two stars are resonating. And because in that frame they are resonating, they can apply a torque one onto the other, and so they can exchange angular momentum. So this is pictured on this diagram. In a non-rotating frame, you wouldn't necessarily guess that these two essentially axisymmetric orbits can torque each other, but it so happened that in a rotating frame, you can see that they can. So this is what's driving the secular evolution of the system, even though it's isolated. So if I look at the distribution of orbits in action space, so this is like a guiding radius and this is like eccentricity, the fluctuation in my system so happened to induce an overdensity for the blue stars here and an overdensity for the red stars here, because these two set of orbits happen to be lines of constant resonant frequency which match each other, so that this condition is satisfied. These two fluctuations can self-amplify. So you would think, well, maybe that's not very interesting because it's just fluctuation, so who cares? But because of the self-gravity that I mentioned earlier, the amplification is going to be boosted by the susceptibility squared, and so it will be strongly amplified by the self-gravity of the system. So the small resonant recurrence induced by the resonances is what's driving the secular evolution of the system via orbital distortion. So this is the corresponding equation. So it's a bit more complicated than the previous one. And as expected, it's quadratic in the distribution function now. Okay, thank you. It has a 1 over n effect because it's driven by the number of systems. So you go in the mean field limit, it's exactly zero. It has a divergence of a flux, and it has this self-gravitating dressed contribution as previously. You can recast it as a diffusion equation as previously, except there's an extra term corresponding to the drift, which you can relate to the previous equation. And you can write its stochastic counterpart. And so you can think of this as a sort of a recipe for n-body simulation, where you're going to evolve the secular evolution of an orbit, but because you've taken into account the dressing via the diffusion coefficient, then each time step already incorporates the whole swing amplification process that has been discussed earlier. So it's potentially very efficient at integrating in time the diffusion of orbits, taking into account the secular. So I guess since I have 5 minutes, I'll skip the derivation, and maybe you're not interested. Well, it's a theory workshop, right? The way you solve the equation is you move to angle action variable, use basis element I've already mentioned, you use numerical linear theory to get the matrix response, and you find lines of constant resonance in action space. And for those who don't want to do that, but it's a pity, you can also use a shortcut, which is you make an ensemble average of simulations, and you look at them in action space. And then you measure the rate of change of action as a function of time by just averaging what's happening on such a diagram for many such simulation. And then you will get a direct measurement of the flux of diffusion in action space. Okay, so does this work? The answer is yes. In a sense that Jerry made an experiment back in 2012 where he looked at this formation of this ridge that I mentioned earlier. And so you see that there's an excess of eccentric orbit which has been generated spontaneously from this distribution to that distribution function, and a depletion of circular orbits. So this is actually the process of radial migration, which incorporates both churning and blurring, in the sense that the guiding center has changed at the same time as the eccentricity. So you've got both heating and change of guiding center at the same time. So this is an example of such a simulation. If you look in configuration space, nothing is happening. But if you look in action space, you see all these ridges which are spontaneously forming in the isolated distribution function. And it's indeed a 1/n effect. So those of you who've read Jerry's paper, you can convince yourself that it's a 1/n effect, so it's really captured by the previous equation. And this is the implementation of the equation using the matrix method versus the simulation. So you notice that the orientation of the ridge is the same. The position is not quite the same, but this is expected because this is one realization and this is the result for an ensemble average. And if you look at how the amplitude of the perturbation is scaling with time, you indeed find that it's a 1/n effect as predicted by the theory. And if you look at the time scale at which it grows, you find that it's consistent with what the simulation is predicting. So I would argue that we've demonstrated that this equation captures the secular evolution in Jerry's simulation. You can switch off, as I mentioned earlier, the self-gravity and convince yourself that self-gravity is primordial in getting the time scale right and the shape of the response, because if you switch off the waves, the spiral basis associated to low frequency, then you get a mismatch. You can switch off self-gravity and you kill the ridge. And I'll just skip that. I want to just give you two more small examples of why it works and why it's relevant for Gaia. You can also try to look for WKB solutions, as I've just mentioned, by using essentially wavelets-like basis over which you're going to expand your response, which has this shape. And when you do that, you recover that the matrix response becomes diagonal. This is essentially what Lin and Xu did, and Tumori, etc., in the 60s. With an element on the diagonal, we just involve the classical reduction factor that these theories have produced. And when you do that, you find that you can match as well the position of the ridge and the depletion of quasi-circular orbit. The reason I mentioned this WKB theory is that you can also apply it to a disk which has some finite thickness. So you can look at the response of a the impact of orbital diffusion on disk thickening, and whereas you can't do that if you don't have this WKB basis. So for instance, here using WKB theory, stop talking. you can see, well, let me just finish on this. You can convince yourself that you can, for instance, change the self-gravity of your disk and find that as you change the self-gravity of the disk, the ridge will move itself from one resonance to the other. So it doesn't have to be always the inner Lindblad resonance, because as I mentioned, the diffusion has this sum over all possible resonance. It's not assuming that one action is fast and we're only considering one specific resonance, considering all resonance at the same time. So this is disk thickening, and this is bar. You can also put a bar in the system and look at where the bar is going to hit the diffusion in action space or in orbital space. And so these are my conclusions, and this was my previous slide. Thank you.
Self-gravity. Yes. When you switch off the self-gravity,
yes.
You switched off all the spiral pattern as well, or take the m equals 2 mode or m equal 4. What is taken on board there?
When we switch off the self-gravity, we basically put m to 0 as the in the gravitational susceptibility. So gravitational susceptibility becomes 1.
Okay.
Does that answer your question, or?
No, the self-gravity effect that you switched off in the simulation. I wasn't sure what was shown.
Little M and big M. You referred to big M. He's talking about little M.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
All little M's are allowed, but big M.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yes. Big M, yes. Big M with a hat. Not one resonance.
So I guess this is less of a question and more like a discussion point that actually I'd be interested in hearing from everybody about, which is I want to speak a little bit in favor of the weather. In the sense that I think the weather can tell us a lot, actually. And in a sense, I kind of agree with you, the weather itself is uninteresting because for galaxies we want to know, I agree about the climate. But on the other hand, you can learn from the weather about the climate. The analogy doesn't quite work. So to be specific, what I'm trying to say is that in Gaia, we're seeing signatures of things that aren't phase averaged. We need both sets, but we do see signatures of things, both approaches to studying galaxies, but we do see things that are not phase average, they're not phase mixed, and we see signatures of impulses, and doing an analysis that's also not phase average can teach you something about that sort of thing as well.
So can I
just say, just to give examples, the phase-based spiral and the GD1 stream, and the holes in the GD1 stream. And lastly, it's not absolutely clear to me that every ridge in the action space and every over-density in angle space is necessarily resonance effects. So I'm just curious what everybody...
So since I'm allowed to speak... I don't disagree with you, as they like to say in English. The point is, I was trying to make clear what this is about, but the assumption of time decoupling is allowing you to take limits so that some Dirac's appear in the formulas. If you want to do a finite time average, you can too, and I would urge you to, because I think this is why I changed a bit my title, etc. I think quasi-linear theory, makes specific predictions in this limit, in the complete time separation, but it can be customized if you don't want to take this limit. I mean, I'm sure meteorologists think weather is important. I wouldn't disagree with that. I think a lot of people are doing either linear theory or n-body simulation. I want to advocate that quasi-linear theory is something in between, which actually is not always correct, obviously. There are some assumptions being made, but it captures a lot more than linear theory. And it should enlighten a lot what you find in simulation, and has the advantage that it gives you already the ensemble average answer, whereas the simulation is just one realization. So I'm not going to claim without proof that all the ridges we see in Velma's diagram are necessarily secular in nature, but I try to insist at the beginning that for instance, you could say, oh, but the bar is not external to the galaxy, and therefore the unperturbed actions are no good. But you can decide as a physicist to make this split, and then you do the theory, and it tells you something. And this theory makes a prediction about the shape of the ridges. It predicts exactly the distribution function in action space. And if you want to do smaller time average, it can probably predict something also in angle space. So yes, this is not the answer to everything. That's a bit advertising, but it should nevertheless be pursued, in my opinion. Anybody else?
So clearly this theory has applications to some problems, but we read assumes integrability,
but first of all, actions are canonical variables. You can write any problem.
I was about to try and.
Oh, sorry.
A question.
I thought that was it.
So we can clearly conceive of some problems in galactic astrophysics where there just isn't an equilibrium, like, for example, in the halo, where just things are falling in and falling in and falling in and falling in. So there are going to be some problems where you are not going to be able to assume an underlying, even close, integrable system.
And what age are you talking about when you talk about halos? Because halos are pretty much in position for quite a while, right? I mean... I would argue that halos in the outskirts, dynamical, it's a matter of ratios of dynamical time to time you're interested in. If the times you're interested in are the order of dynamical time, obviously secular theory is incorrect. But if you're interested, so in the outskirts, we're talking about 20, 50 dynamical times, so it's not so good, right? But you wouldn't argue that the galactic center, for instance, has a long dynamical time compared to Hubble time, so.
I think I can accept that this theory has a lot of applications in the galactic disk. But on one of the slides that you speedily went through, Christoph,
okay.
A whole array of problems were solved with this mechanism. And there I have more doubts.
Okay, so what we... Wow, great opportunity to go through a slide I skipped. So yes. Galactic centers, we published a few papers on it, so you can read them, but it works actually quite well. Cusp core and feedback. So we've been trying to work on this for quite some while. Is that what you have in mind? Which one do you have in mind?
Look at the galactic halo problems. So do you believe you can solve these problems with quasi-linear perturbation theory?
Well, I can certainly enlighten them. Cusp core is the center. Dynamical times are short, so I'm pretty convinced I can tackle the cusp core transformation. I guess the more debatable is this one, maybe the streams. The streams are not very phased mixed. The least you can say, because they've only extended to a few angles. But nevertheless, if you want to ask yourself how does the orbit distort itself, fundamentally it's captured by... I feel like a fisherman trying to sell his fish. I mean, this is not supposed to be a scientific talk, not a... But the wake is completely taken into account here.
Okay, so you take all this with you in the distribution function, but it wouldn't be a phased average yet, right?
That's what I just said. It's not very phased average, so it's a bit... The reason I mentioned this is because people here were interested and they were saying, what can we constrain using these streams? I would argue you can measure the fluctuation of the power spectrum of the potential. And I started working on this topic because I was... interacting with Ibata after the Sagittarius discovery. So this is how I got involved, so I'm getting back to it, I guess, but...
I think Josh was next. Yeah, so to going to Wynne's point about the importance of this kind of work for the disk, I don't even know the paper by Ida et al., which seems to get ignored for reasons I never followed, the dispersions in the disk and the long-range forces in the disk, you know, the radial, vertical, and tangential dispersion... Is it, sigma, phi,
yes.
Seems to me that you could look at that here, see if you can get the relative dispersion ratios for the galaxy given a fluctuating local, you know, the GMCs, which only live for 20 million years. They do not live forever. They're always coming and going, swing amplifying locally, then coming and going somewhere else, and look at the impact of the long-range forces, the fact the disk is flat, for, you know, the massive disk is flat a long way out, not spherical.
So this is the slide I skipped about the applying the algorithm or the methods to disk thickening. So you're looking at diffusion this time as a function of JZ,
yeah.
Right? And so you find these ridges that were you recover these ridges that were found by Solway in 2012. And if you project this, now you have a distribution function.
Yes.
So I can project them into kinematic space, and I get a disk thickening as a function of dispersion as a function of cosmic time.
But I think I'm right in saying, tell me if I'm wrong, that they're the only analytic model that gets the dispersion ratios right in the disk. Is that not right, James?
No, you're right. Then people have got it right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're not actually connecting with Christoph, because you're talking about... The scattering problem.
So it just seems to me this is a perfect framework to see if that's right.
Yeah. Okay.
That should be looked at. It's a classical problem. It has never really been.
Okay.
Anybody else?
Yes.
Catherine's already had a go. Does anybody else want to have a question before I...
Okay, sorry. So I just want to be clear. I think this work is great. It's not... So I don't want you to take... What I said earlier is criticism. It was just merely saying, being sure that we kept an eye on different tools being relevant
sure.
to different regimes. And the question about streams and fluctuations, I think you pointed out that this would be really good for getting the power spectrum, which I agree with, on the for the low end of the power spectrum. But I guess going back, the individual signatures that we see in streams, those are individual events. So that would be, that would go back to using your technique in a finite time scale instead of a phase average, right?
Yes.
So it's just, I mean, I guess all I was trying to say was the weather is useful too.
Sure.
Okay, let's take this up again.
Especially in Santa Barbara.